Well, it's a great pleasure to be here again, and I want to thank particularly Hans Friele, Manon Bloch, and Gino, who helped collectively to find the story that I'm going to read today, which is called The Professor. A slight fall of snow during the night had covered the aerodrome of Squadron Number 266, RFC, with a thin white mantle, and a low-hanging canopy of indigo-tinted cloud stretching from horizon to horizon held a promise of more to come. Captain Bigglesworth, from the window of the officers' mess, contemplated the wintry scene for the 10th time with bored impatience, then turned to a group of officers who were gathered around the mess fire, discussing such matters of professional interest as machine guns, bullets, and shooting generally. "Every now and then you'll get a gunner who knows his stuff, but a lot of them don't. Look at it this way. Suppose you're diving at 150 miles an hour at 20,000 feet up. 150 miles an hour is over 200 feet a second. It takes about 20 seconds for a shell to reach 20,000 feet. So if the gunner aims at the machine without allowing deflection, the machine is about a mile away when the shell bursts," he concluded emphatically. "It's purely a matter of mathematics," said a quiet voice near at hand. Biggle started, and all eyes turned towards the speaker, a small, round-faced youth who was reclining in a cane chair. He nodded solemnly as he realized that everyone was looking at him.
"Did you say something?" said Biggles, with a questioning stare.
"I said that deflection shooting was, in my opinion, purely a matter of mathematics," replied the youth, blinking owlishly. A bellow of laughter split the air, for Henry Watkins, the speaker, had joined the squadron in France, direct from a flying training school, about 1 hour earlier. And these were the first words he'd been heard to utter.
"What makes you think so, laddie?"
asked Biggles, with a wink at McLaren, when the mirth had subsided. "Well, I've analysed this very desideratum, theoretically, of course," confessed Henry, "and I long ago reached the conclusion that Euclidean precision with a machine gun can be determined by a simple mathematical, or should I say algebraical, formula."
"Is that so? And are you going to do sums in the air before you start shooting, eh?"
grinned Biggles. "Why not?" returned Henry quickly. "Mental arithmetic is always fascinating, and logarithms will lick luck every time. I have evolved a pet theory of my own, which will probably revolutionize the whole art of aerial combat, and I'm anxious to test it in practice at the first available opportunity."
"That's fine. Well, you won't have long to wait," interposed Biggles grimly. "You'll get your chance just as soon as this muck lifts."
He indicated the cloud with an upward sweep of his thumb. "Good," replied Henry calmly. Perhaps you'd like me to show you my idea. Now, for the sake of example, let us assume that a hostile aircraft, or Hun, if you prefer the common colloquialism, is proceeding along a path of flight, which we'll call AB, banking at an angle of, shall we say, 30 degrees or so. These two coffee cups will indicate the imaginary line, he went on, arranging the two cups on a card table in front of the fire. Now, I'm approaching in my camel plane on a course which we'll call CD. Two more cups, thanks, at an angle of bank of 60 degrees. Now, by a combination of factors, which I will presently explain, I will demonstrate to you that a prolongation of the muzzle of my Vickers guns will intercept the geometrical arc AC in x seconds, plus the cube root of the square of the chord BC. Very simple question. Now, if I equal y, broke in Biggles in a dazed voice. Yes, I said why. I mean what for, Biggles demanded. Well, call me Zed if you like. It's all the same. Hold hard, cried Biggles. What's all this about? What's all this XYZ stuff anyway? I'm not a blinking triangle. You can be the whole blooming alphabet if you like, as far as I'm concerned. And if you think you can knock Huns down by drawing imaginary lines, you go ahead. Well, there it is. And that's all there is to it, said Henry, with a shrug of resignation. The whole thing is purely a matter of mathematics. Mathematics, my eye. If you start working out sums on my patrol, I'll show you a new line of flight with the cube root of my foot when we get back on the ground, promised Biggles, scowling. The door opened, and Major Mullen, the CO, entered.
This stuff is not going to lift, I'm afraid, he said, nodding to the window. But we shall have to try to put up a show of some sort or other, or Wing Headquarters will start a scream. What about dropping a few Cooper bombs on a Jerry aerodrome? Aerodrome number 32, for instance. Eh, Bigglesworth?
Good enough, sir. That suits me, replied Biggles. Anything for a quiet life. I'll go crazy if I loaf around here toasting in front of the fire much longer.
Henry sprang to his feet and started off towards the door.
Aye, where do you think you are off to? Called Biggles. I thought I was going to bomb aerodrome number 32. Am I not coming with you? Cried Henry in dismay.
You? I should say so. Sit down and don't be so silly, growled
Biggles.
You'd be lost to the world in 5 minutes if you got into that soup. You get a pencil and paper and go on working out your sums.
Lost? Bird, snorted Henry. With a good compass, it's impossible to get lost. Cloud flying is purely a matter of mathematics.
Major Mullen smiled.
Who told you that?
He asked in surprise.
Don't you start him off on that ABC stuff again, sir, protested Biggles quickly. He reckons he is going to shoot Huns down by algebra.
He turned to Henry.
Look here, kid, he said. I don't want to discourage you, but do you think you could keep me in sight if I let you come with me?
Keep you in sight? Echoed Henry. Of course I could.
By mathematics, I suppose?
Certainly. 10 minutes later, they took off in a swirl of snow, and climbing swiftly, soon reached the gloom of the cloud bank. At 4,000 feet, Biggles burst out at the top into brilliant sunshine, with a suddenness that was startling, and looked around quickly for the other two camels. Algy emerged from the opaque vapor about 50 yards away and instantly took up his position close to Biggles' right wingtip. But of Henry, there was no sign. Presently, Henry's camel appeared again, far to the east, still heading out over hostile country. Biggles ground his teeth and let him go. He could not have caught him up anyway. He made a despairing gesture to Algy in the other camel, and then, turning, they sped away together towards the objective aerodrome. Meanwhile, Henry was not having such a happy time. Somehow or other, his carefully prepared plans were not panning out as he'd fondly imagined they would.
His troubles started early. In fact, from the very moment that he lost sight of his companions in the clammy, impenetrable fog. After the first shock of discovery that he could no longer see his leader, he fixed his eyes on the instrument board and prepared to keep the machine on its course until he'd climbed above the snow cloud. But he quickly discovered this was not so easy as a careful study of his flying training manual had led him to believe. Steering an erratic course, he at last broke through the surface of the fog, like a whale coming up for air, and looked around eagerly for the other machines. They were nowhere in sight. His jaw sagged foolishly, and he stared in turn at the four points of the compass in comical consternation. A terrible feeling of loneliness gripped him as he slowly realized that he was alone in the sky. He just made a mental note that the dangers of war flying had been grossly exaggerated by the other pilots who had spoken to him about it, when a strange noise reached his ears above the powerful roar of his Bentley rotary engine. It sounded like someone knocking on a stone with a hammer at incredible speed. He was wondering vaguely what it could be when, with a loud whang, the altimeter, which he happened to be watching, flew to pieces in a little shower of broken glass and metal. He started so violently that he automatically jerked back in his seat, unconsciously pulling the control stick back at the same time. The movement undoubtedly saved his life, for looking over the side of his cockpit, he was just in time to see two lines of glittering sparks streaking across the spot where he had been a fraction of a second before. And then his eye fell on something else, something that brought his heart to his mouth and made him stare in blank astonishment. He would have been prepared to swear that there was not another machine in the sky except his own. But there, not 50 yards away, was a large green aeroplane with a huge black cross on its side. It was a two-seater, and as he stared in horrified amazement, the gunner in the rear cockpit was calmly removing empty ammunition drums and replacing them with new ones. Vaguely at the back of his mind, Henry felt sure he ought to do something, but for the life of him, he could not think what it was. His brain refused to act. Uppermost in his mind was the certain knowledge that within the next 3 seconds, that calm, dispassionate, muffled figure in the back seat would direct a deadly stream of bullets at him. He shifted his gaze to the pilot and stared fascinated at the distorted eyes of the German, glaring at him through the big round goggles above a flowing blonde moustache. Henry waited for no more. Just what stunt he did, he could never afterwards say, but he admitted frankly that he pulled, pushed, and stepped on everything within reach. Even as he shot up in a crazy loop, came the knowledge that he too had a gun and could shoot back. Quivering with excitement, he leveled out, gripped the Bowden lever of his guns, and tore back at the green machine. It was not there. He pushed up his goggles and looked again, unable to believe his eyes. Where the green machine had been, there now stretched an infinite expanse of gleaming white mist, and above, the pale blue wintry sky. "This isn't flying, it's conjuring," he groaned. "Where the dickens can he have got to?" He leaned far over the side of the cockpit, searching high and low for the attacker. He'd just decided, with infinite relief, that in some unaccountable manner it had disappeared, when, with a sharp staccato stutter, louder than before, he heard the terrible cry in his ears. He jumped violently and looked again over the other side. The green machine was almost on top of him, bearing straight down on him, a streak of orange flame leaping from the pilot's gun on the engine cowling. At the sight, a feeling of uncontrollable rage swept over Henry. "What do you think you are, a jack-in-the-box?" he snarled furiously, and flung the camel round in its own length, at the same time grabbing for his gun lever. The chattering throb of his own guns almost startled him. In his heart, he felt quite certain that they were going to collide. It seemed unavoidable. But remembering Biggle's instructions about not turning away from a head-on attack, he did not swerve an inch. He had a fleeting vision of two wheels missing his top plane by 6 inches as the other plane swept up over him. He was round in a flash, blind rage swamping all other emotions. "Go about smashing people's altimeters, would you, you dirty dog?" he muttered, as his eye fell on the German diving steeply towards the clouds. He thrust his control stick forward in an endeavour to overtake it. But before he could reach it, the other plane had plunged out of sight into the mist, where he knew it would be useless to follow, and he turned away disconsolately. As he looked around, he realized with something of a shock that he was by no means certain of his position. But he struck off in what he thought was the right position, the right direction, for the German aerodrome. He kept a wary eye on the sky and got the fright of his life when 3 SE-5s burst out of the fog just in front of him. His heart was still palpitating when the pilots waved a cheery greeting to him as they passed. "Well, according to my reckoning, that German aerodrome can't be far away now," he thought. And throttling back, he dropped down through the unbroken sea of cloud. As he came out, he looked below hopefully. It was nearly dark, but there, sure enough, was a row of drab hangars on the edge of an aerodrome. "And Biggles said I couldn't find my way," he scoffed, as he put his nose down in a deep dive. "They haven't found it themselves yet, anyway," he muttered, noting the undisturbed atmosphere on the ground. To and fro across the sheds he dived, working his bomb toggle swiftly until all 8 bombs had been released. He looked below with profound interest as he climbed once more for the clouds, but found to his bitter disappointment that the smoke from his bursting bombs had obscured the view. Dimly, he could just make out groups of men rushing about like ants, pouring out of hangars and huts and waving their arms at him furiously. "Ha-ha," he smiled, "hold that little lot." And then, realizing it would be unwise to tempt Providence by staying in the vicinity too long, he soared into the sunlight above the clouds and headed for home. He was not quite certain of the direction, but he knew that by flying on a southwesterly course, he would at least reach British lines and safety, after which it would not take him long to find his own aerodrome at Marinique. With his lips pursed in an inaudible whistle and his heart bounding with the joy of a job well done, he dropped once more through the mist in search of home. Biggles and Algy were also racing home above the mist with that curious certainty of position which some airmen seem to possess. After gliding through the concealing curtain of cloud, they picked up the aerodrome, landed, and taxied quickly towards the waiting mechanics. Biggles pushed the mess door wide open. Henry and Major Mullen were standing in the middle of the room, surrounded by a circle of pilots. "So, you found it all right," said Biggles, keeping a straight face with an effort. "Of course. Worked out mathematically, it was impossible to miss it," replied Henry casually. Biggles turned to a window to watch an SE-5 land on the aerodrome and taxi tail up towards the mess. A moment later, Major Sharp of Squadron Number 287, breathing heavily, stood swaying on the threshold. He appeared to have some difficulty in finding his voice. Biggles, a grim suspicion already forming in his mind, turned a questioning eye on Henry and showed his teeth in a mirthless grin. "Which of you fools has been fanning my aerodrome?" barked the Major. There was a silence which could be felt. 8 confounded great holes all over the aerodrome. Fortunately, nobody hurt. It'll take my men all day to fill 'em. It was a camel. We saw it. No argument. Its number was J7743, muttered Biggles involuntarily. "How do you know that?" cried Henry hotly. "That's the number of my machine." "Oh, mathematics. Purely a matter of mathematics," said Biggles softly. The telephone rang shrilly, and Major Mullen picked up the receiver.
"Hello?"
"Yes," he said.
"Yes, what's that?" "Oh, good show. Just a minute, and I'll ask them."
He turned towards the other pilots in the room. "Did you have a go at a green Hanoveriana this afternoon, Biggles? The artillery are on the line, and they report a green Hanoveriana crashed on landing about half an hour ago near St. Paul. The engine was shot to bits, and the gunner was dead." "No, I haven't seen a two-seater," replied Biggles in astonishment.
"Nor I," admitted Algy. "It's all right. I got it," said Henry casually.
"What? Did you shoot at a green Hanoveriana this afternoon?" cried Biggles in amazement.
"I did," replied Henry modestly, "and the last I saw of it, it was going down through the clouds."
"By the anti-clockwise propeller of my sainted aunt, you must have hit it. How on earth did you manage that?" almost shouted Biggles.
"Oh, mathematics. It was purely a matter of mathematics," replied Henry, grinning, as a howl of laughter split the air.
"Mathematics, my eye. How did you work it out, anyway?" snorted Biggles.
"Well, it was this way," replied Henry modestly. "This Boche thought he was smart. He seemed to think that one Hanoveriana plus one camel only equaled one Hanoveriana, which, as Euclid would say, is absurd. I got angry and decided to show him where he was wrong, and that one camel plus one Hanoveriana equaled one camel. The thing that annoyed me was that he popped about so fast that I hadn't time to prove my theorem."
"I had an idea you'd discover that," grinned Biggles. "But how did you get him at the finish?"
"Well, if I must tell the truth," he grinned, "I threw my copybook at the cloud and went for him bald-headed. I let drive with my Vickers, and down he went, and that was that. I didn't know I'd hit him. He just buzzed off in the soup where I couldn't follow him, and that was the last I saw of him. Then I beetled around until I found the aerodrome and unloaded my eggs."
"Yes, I think the less you say about that, the better," advised Biggles, with a sidelong glance at the Major.
"The point is, you got a hun. And if you'll leave your copybook at home in future, follow me, and do your fighting by the bald-headed method, you can come with me tomorrow. Is it a go?"
"It is," declared Henry emphatically.